putting this on Sten.
That's good. We had to rent a mobile phone because we don't have a mobile phone. And with 16 people coming in and out, you want to be able to connect with them and, you know, I'm lost, towards the train station, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
And so we rented the thing. It only worked in Italy, which is good.
Uh-huh.
And first guests were friends from college. And so I sat down with one of them and said, okay, Bob, I have no idea in the world how to do texts, you know, how to do any of this stuff. And so we had a nice 7-minute
tutorial
how to use a cell phone. It's quite exciting.
That's a pretty fancy rig.
Yeah, it's archival quality. It's got all sorts of other doodads in the here. There shouldn't be a problem, but it's got, you know, the cover and got a little stick you can put it in if you want to lift it up. And
very nice.
So I, in the past, have sung with an extremely good choir, and I take this to concerts with the permission of the conductor, and I record it, and then that night I just go home and I send it to him and say, here, you're not going to get the recording that you did for weeks.
Right.
So if you need it to listen to.
Right.
Or you want to take it and, you know, it's all MP3, I can turn it into MP3s from the archival stuff.
So, you know, so you can play is it done as a WAV file then? Or?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And it's got several layers of WAV file. I got this thing, and as I was checking them, I was always, okay, Ava, so what's archival? And so she went to the Smithsonian site.
Right.
What's archival, blah, 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 blah.
The Smithsonian put on, or the Library of Congress put on a seminar, and the people from the state archives went to it with the agreement that the only thing they had to pay for it was to do public seminars when they got back.
Oh, what they learned, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so they did a series of three of them. And the most important thing that I learned out of all of that is do it in the best possible archival that you have now, and then have a regular schedule of updating it.
Right.
So if you've got some 78 RPMs exactly. and you haven't been updating it, you're dead meat.
You're dead, yeah. Exactly.
And this is the place at the Library of Congress where they literally maintain
all
of that hardware. I mean, they buy old Ampex room-sized videotape machines so that if they happen to run into a piece of tape that's on that and nothing else, and it happens to be of Kennedy that they didn't know about before.
Right. Then they can run it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that's great. Yeah, so what I do is I take these, I take it home, and I do an archival one, boom, and then I've got a nice sound editing setup, all freeware, and so I convert it into the highest level of MP3 for the stuff that I'm going to do. And then, like with the governor, I actually then broke it up because, you know, he wanders. So we'd have, you know, here's the discussion about this, and it might be 6 minutes, it might be 8 minutes, and so I have a separate one for him. Okay. For all the rest of you, I'm going to do just a straight transcription. Which is now also automatic on my computer.
Yeah,
new software.
Amazing stuff.
I just put it in there. I'm going to train it to your voice, and it's just going to go, and I'll tell it where the paragraphs are.
My nephew, who is the chief executive officer of Vocera, which is a primarily hospital communication badge, and he says training it to a voice is cheating. He said you need to have voice recognition and text transfer based upon anybody's voice,
exactly.
because these badges are used by, you know, 5 different people in 3 shifts.
And yeah. So yeah,
but it's still, even though it's cheating, it works better.
It does. One of the issues with the governor was his voice got weaker.
Raspier.
And so I've had to, and there are 3 versions of him. So it'll transcribe. But just over I first interviewed him in December, and just from December until June.
Yeah,
well, getting raspier and a little bit weaker. And
yep.
He's 91.
Yeah.
And he's Louise.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to start out all these interviews with the not Vicatias is just start out telling how you ran into this guy and, you know, what your relationship was to him. And then we'll get into details as we go on.
I may have met him at a Portland Beaver baseball game. neither one of us could remember. By the way, I'm still speaking of him in the present tense.
I do the same.
Okay. So I apologize to whoever might be hearing this tape down the road. It's going to probably wander back and forth between present and past tense. Yeah. But we talked about this once, and Tony Yeturi was supposed to go to a game. And it happened to be that Harmon Killebrew was there as a part of the festivities, whether he was playing or whether he was just there. Harmon Killebrew comes from Payette, Idaho. I was a radio station guy in Ontario, and so I went there to interview my friend, my acquaintance, Harmon Killebrew.
Right.
And I believe that either Representative or Senator Atiyah was there because Yeturi couldn't make it. And we tried to look it up, and all that. The time I officially met him was early January 1977, and the way I came about meeting him was I was on the faculty at Oregon State, and I was one of the last tenure track regular faculty instructor people hired primarily as an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
I was hired on December 15th, 1971. On January 1, they stopped doing that.
Right.
That's, it seemed at the time like good news, except I was on tenure track and did not have a PhD, didn't even have a master's degree, and although I taught some film classes and things like that that I knew a lot about, I didn't get tenure.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, I've got, the standard year's notice, and I was disappointed at the time, and I thought, my career was over, and I was just despondent over the whole thing. But, as it turns out, hindsight, I had been working on political campaigns for Tony Van Vliet since he began campaigning for office. And just as a volunteer, he was just part of a coffee clutch that I went to.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down and talked to Tony, and I said, I'm looking and interested in doing something. And he said, well, there's this guy, Vic Atiyah. He's a state senator. He ran for governor. But, oh, yeah, I remember that. And this, again, is about late 76. And he's looking for a caucus assistant for the Republican caucus in the Senate. And you'd be perfect for it. But it's only going to be a six-month job. And I'm thinking, well, all right, I'm going to need a job. And six-month job, I went to my boss, and he said, well, we'll give you a leave of absence. That's great. We'd love to have people that learn about the legislative system, even though, you'll bring something back.
Right.
And as it turned out, my year's notice was extended beyond that. They didn't count the leave. So, that was a bonus.
Yeah.
And so I went down and I interviewed. And this was in the new wings. They just moved into the new wings. And I interviewed in is now completely changed because they did all that remodeling, but I interviewed with him and Glenna Hayden. And he couldn't figure out why I wanted the job either, but I wasn't going to tell him that I didn't get tenure.
Right.
Because people don't necessarily even understand what that concept is. And we talked, and he hired me on the spot. He said, if you can come. I said, well, I just need to check with, things and that kind of stuff. Went back to my boss, Sam Bailey, and he said, yeah, well, let's arrange a leave of absence for you. So I took a leave of absence and was there for the entire session, which lasted, quote, a lengthy session. I think it was the longest on record, 4th of July or something. And now that, before the double session times, that would have been considered long. And worked in communications for a gigantic caucus of six.
Yes.
And as Barbara Roberts says in her book, while it might have been a small caucus, look at what they all did. One became governor, one became state treasurer, one became a congressman, and the list, goes on.
Right.
And so it was a very, it was a great caucus, a great people to work with. Interestingly, it was a caucus, and if Bob Smith were sitting right here, and this is all obviously on the record, Bob Smith evidently had tried to go for minority leader as well and didn't win.
Oh, okay.
So Bob Smith never came to a single caucus meeting. And I say that even though he physically was there for about 45 seconds because Tony Meeker grabbed him, Senator Meeker grabbed him, drug him into the room and said, okay, now you've been to a caucus meeting. He said, okay, see you later, and he was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a great experience meeting some good people, learning about the legislative process, learning about some of the systems that they had available to them at that time, and also getting to know Vic Atiyah.
Yeah.
I always tried, except for the first day when I didn't have a key, I was commuting from Corvallis, and I always tried to be there before the senator arrived, and in typical sort of now Washington, D.C. style, not leave until he was gone.
Right.
And most of the time I was able to pull that off because clearly my goal was to impress him and the other people because I was thinking there might be some jobs involved in that.
Yeah.
So that was the first contact that I had with him.
So how did that build to eventually being his communications director? Was that just you eventually became part of his Senate staff?
Or well, no. I was there.
It's time for the campaign.
Yeah, when you're the caucus communications person. Glenn right. Hayden was entitled the caucus administrator, but mm-hmm. you basically work for the leader.
Right.
And the other people have a legislative assistant in those days. I don't know what it's expanded to now. And so in that process, I got to know him directly. And I threw hints around because I said, what are you going to do? Are you going to run again? And things like that. And he honestly had not decided yet.
Yeah.
And by the time he decided he was going to run, I was back at Oregon State and was on the job market and was looking and doing my job there as things went on. And I remember that I've talked to him since, obviously, about what was he thinking, what was I thinking, and that kind of thing. And he was thinking, boy, it would be great to have Denny in the campaign if I decide to run. And I was thinking it would be great to be in a campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But neither one of us thought the other person knew that or figured that out or whatever. And so I kept dropping hints, especially with Glenna. And eventually I dropped enough hints that he called me up and he said, are you really willing to leave? Because he was announced and mm-hmm. I was back at Oregon State.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you leave a good job at Oregon State? Me not telling him that I was going to leave that job anyway.
Right.
And so I just said, look, I want to do this. This sounds like a lot of fun. Well, I did. And he hired me and I was the communications director for the 78 campaign,
mm-hmm.
and in that process, my father just came unglued. My father was pretty critical of just about anything I did, and he mm-hmm. thought I'd made this gigantic mistake, because anybody who even just reads the Blue Book or reads any clippings from that time knows that Dick Atiyeh was, in fact, going to come in third in a three-way primary race.
The primary, much less the general, right.
Yeah. I mean, they're not even thinking about the general because
right.
he wouldn't make it.
Yeah.
And that was the conventional wisdom at the time.
Yeah.
And so I can't use the language my father used with me, but it was very, very colorful about how I had screwed up big time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as it turns out, we won. So.
Mm-hmm. So you were there for the primary and the general. So talk to me, I mean, clearly for readers of this book, Roger Martin, nice footnote, but Tom McCall's the story. So talk about, from your side, from your view, and I've talked to the governor about this several times, what it was like dealing with Tom McCall as opponent and then, after the primary when you're supposed to come together.
Well, we didn't come together.
Mm-hmm.
That's a start right there. Tom announced that he wasn't going to be endorsing anyone. I'm getting ahead of myself,
mm-hmm.
and I'll come back.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't going to endorse anyone because, after all, he was going to go back onto television and be a commentator, and he couldn't
right.
endorse anyone. We were thankful he didn't endorse anyone. We were worried more about him endorsing Straub than
right.
than anything else. But in terms of dealing, let me just treat it broadly. First of all, in a three-way race, everyone was scared to death that there was going to be a splitting of the, quote, conservative side.
Right.
And in 1974, in my opinion, the candidate, Dick Atiyeh, got pushed into the conservative mode.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in 1974, conservative meant something different than it means today.
Right.
Just like all of these political labels, there's a huge amount of change that goes on. He might have said to you, I haven't changed. Why has my label changed?
Exactly.
I'm the same person. Now I'm the moderate or right of center or whatever
right.
that might mean, and I'm still the same person I've always been.
Yeah.
What's going on here? And I said, well, the world is moving, and you're just staying where you are,
mm-hmm.
and you have to. The labels change as the world changes. But Roger, in those days, Roger's a factor here, and I realize for the
mm-hmm.
book that Tom is the draw, but in those days you could raise money during the session. You could gather in your troops during the session. You could, he had Greg Walden working for him during the session. He was half on kind of a lobbyist, paid for half his salary, and the state paid for the other half, and he was gearing up with all this campaign staff,
mm-hmm.
basically campaigning for governor while being a legislator. And that in those days, it was perfectly legitimate, perfectly legal, and he had credit for it.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone in the establishment of the Republican Party was saw, you know, Roger's got money, Roger's got charisma, Roger's got all this going for him, and as a result, he's our best chance against Tom McCall.
Right.
It was kind of the moderate to conservative side against, oh my God, anti-business Tom McCall, and then McCall will certainly win the general election, and we'll have another 8 years of Tom McCall. And I don't know if the governor told you or if you've read about in Brent Wolf's book, although Brent kind of got it wrong, the famous meeting in Woodburn where supposedly they were going to decide who was going to be the one that everyone was going to get behind.
Yeah, Brent writes about it as a secret thing where, you know, all this kind of stuff. And talking to the governor, that was, there were, it didn't sound like the same meeting.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, and I wasn't there, so I can't talk about it, but in terms of being personally there, but I do know that the governor thought he was going down to basically, they kind of talked to him and said, you know, we're going to get together and we're going to, you know, get behind you and all this kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden, here's Roger and here's he. And it's a setup. It's a total setup. And then when he said, quote, no, you don't understand, I'm going to win, they then leaked it that he'd been asked to withdraw. And then the battle was on at that point. So in terms of Tom, the governor, I believe, has already said on your tape and the Historical Society tape that Tom, bless his soul, believed that he was going to announce, and as the governor would say, ta-da, there would be this, you know, huge, loving, welcoming kind of experience, which there was not, because a lot of those people were gone, you know, and he'd lost a lot of that kind of support. Plus, he really wasn't a campaigner, didn't like campaigning, certainly did not like to fundraise, so he had less money than the other two candidates. I don't have the public record in front of me, but I'm assuming that. And he just figured that all he had to do was maybe buy. He didn't want to debate. In fact, the advisors said, don't debate, because you'll get baited into things. And his campaign staff, we knew, late in the primary campaign, were picking out apartments and homes in Salem. So the overconfidence factor was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And in a lot of respects, Roger, who now, I've listened to him tell this story many times at something called the old fogies or old timers group that gets together, believes that he won the race for Vicatia because he was the one who went after Tom McCall.
Right.
And in some ways, you know, he's got a little bit of credence there because we like to just say we held, you know, Roger's coat while in the debates especially, where Roger went at, because somebody had to do it, is the way he put it. Well, here comes this very nice, affable, nice-looking, steady, experienced person against Roger, who self-described fiery, you know, gusto kind of thing, against Tom, who showed that he didn't, and I don't know if you've reviewed those tapes or not, but it basically showed he really did not have control over the issues, which is his style of management. He flew very, very high. And every time we'd have a debate, we'd bump up in the polls. And you may have heard the story that when the Oregonian came out with their poll 10 days beforehand, and it showed that Atiyah was ahead of Martin and closing on McCall, even though McCall had the lead, both Tom McCall and Vic Atiyah said Atiyah's won it. Because we knew that all of the Roger Martin anti-McCall sentiment would shift, and in 10 days it did. It was just an overwhelming shift. And yeah, we can get into the more details of election night story and another mistake that Brent made, but you know, it's for Tom, it was crushing. You know, it was a personal insult to him. And this is a guy I got to know as reporter press secretary after that. And we had a very good relationship. I kept calling him governor, and he said, oh, call me Tom. You know, I'm just Tom. I said, no, you're governor. I'm sorry. Once you're a governor or a colonel or a president, and you keep that title.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just the way it's going to be, governor. And he said, oh, all right.
No, in fact, the governor told me, I think, 3 or 4 times the story of election night.
Okay, good.
You know, going over there and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
And
that gets you thinking. That gets into another issue. Say what you were going to say, and
I was just saying that a lot of this is really good because what the Oregon Historical Society did in terms of their oral history is great, you know, and it covers a lot of detail. And they obviously had more time with him than you had with him, and so on. But that was still when he was kind of pulling punches a little bit. and not with quite as much detail as I'm sure he got into in your chances to interview with him. So he was a lot kinder to some people back then, and he said, well, you know, okay, and all this kind of stuff, but it's different. It's
interesting, because there's also, there's another way, because he's become kinder to people since 20 years ago.
That's true, too.
Especially the Democratic governors, except for Goldschmidt.
Mm-hmm. Did he mention him by name?
No. He didn't. He was, yeah, exactly. But Roberts, I mean, it's Roberts is in office when he's talking in
92-93.
Mm-hmm. And he's frustrated with some of the things she's doing and you know, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And Goldschmidt, you know, the scandal certainly had not hit. And so he's frustrated with him and, you know, feels strongly about things that the legislature let Goldschmidt do that they wouldn't let him do. You know, so things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so Goldschmidt's in his own world. But hearing him talk in the past 6 months in detail about Roberts and Kulongoski, it's like he's talking about different people.
Right. Well, they both become good friends.
They've become good friends. There's a, you know, the club of ex-governors. There's a real appreciation, I think. As well as him, you know, he's in his late 80s and early 90s.
Right. So. I really called it for years the Red Baron Syndrome. And I don't know if in World War I, 100 years ago, they really did have respect for their enemies.
Saluting,
as they went down and so on and so forth. But using that anyway as the metaphor of having respect for your enemies, they've all been through the same football game, in effect. And so it's shake hands afterwards, and they got the same bruises that you got, and they understood it and so on. And you still may disagree with them on issues, but you respect them for having been in that office. It's, it's really a respect for the office more than anything else.
Yeah.
I mean, the maddest he ever got at Governor Kitzhaber was on Inauguration Day when Kitzhaber wore jeans to the inauguration.
I got the letter.
Yeah. Oh, he was mad.
You bet. And he also, he brought the same thing. He would talk about the Western Governors Association and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But the same kind of thing. You know, it really didn't matter that they were Republican or Democrat. We'd gone through the same thing. We knew how we got here. And some people were really respected and some people weren't. But
yeah, the Western governors, I mean, the strongest it's got to have a motion detector. The strongest Democrat in most cases was about the same as a Republican from Oregon anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you got into somebody from Colorado or California, they were all interested in the same issues. And as long as you talked about natural resources, you were right in line with
golden.
Democratic governor of Montana or Washington or Idaho, whatever.
Yeah.
Has Idaho had a Democratic governor? It must have, yes. Andrus had to be.
Yeah, Cecil.
Yeah.
But I think that's about it. That you have to go back to labor and silver days, probably.
we digress.
So what I was going to get
at,
which comes up pretty clearly in his story of election night and going over to McCall, he gave the impression that he did things in the campaign that his staff didn't want him to do. So talk to me about that. Was that the case? I mean, talking to him...
And vice versa. By the way.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. But talking to him, you know, pressing him on things, a lot of his campaigning came down to feeling. This is how I felt. I didn't look at the polls. I felt there's only one election that he really couldn't call about himself when he was back in the legislature. He thought he had lost it as he was driving to the party, and it turns out he won it. But he had that's the only election he had no sense about how he was going to do. He knew he was going to lose in 74. He knew he was going to win, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And so he had really a great confidence in his gut feeling. But also, except for a couple of the state legislative races and the loss to Straub, you know, he really never really had tough elections either.
Oh, and I disagree. So, isn't that going to be fun? He didn't, the results looked good.
Yeah.
But, you know,
The governor's races, because governor's races are always tough unless you're Bill Sizemore.
can I write that down?
Sure, you can.
Okay, two more.
But, you know, statewide races are going to be tough, but it's like he honed this in state legislative races where he very rarely had.
Yeah, he was in it, initially he didn't come in first, but he was in a multi-member district.
Right.
Two Republicans came in, and he represented an area that was pretty straightforward there, and people knew him in that area. But yeah, I guess I would say that I can't remember the initial part of your question, but in terms of
basically, did he behave as you wanted him to?
Oh, well, no. You know, he loves short sleeve shirts, and that wasn't. And you know, there's a uniform out there that you wear long sleeve shirts and a red tie and so on. And there's some research actually that it's pretty. You know, people see that kind of image and they have respect for it. We used to joke in the 78 campaign that there was going to be this news brief in the paper that Senator Vicatia's house had been broken into, but strangely, the only things that were missing were two camel sport coats and a whole rack of short-sleeve shirts.
Right.
But then we figured he'd go out and buy a bunch of short-sleeve shirts anyway. We were having a conversation about what he ought to be buried in, and I said, well, whatever it is, it's not going to be a long sleeve shirt, okay? And the kids said, yeah, we know, so he would not like to do that, and he was, he's talked to you about Paul Newman, I'm sure, the consultant, and Paul Newman is a genius, and we were trying to run him down. He's like gone underground in Hawaii someplace, and literally a genius. Ideas just flowing all the time, but also wanting to control things. You know, as a lot of consultants, speaking as one a retired political consultant, you want to be in control, and you want to craft the message, and you want then the parrot to repeat it and repeat it every time, over and over and over again, whether you're running for president or dog catcher. And so he was not disciplined in that regard at all, because he had been 20 years plus in the legislature, and or was going to be 20 years in the legislature, and that wasn't his style. And he was open to questions, and he would respond. He has probably told you, and he said to a lot of people, that it was impossible to lie because he had a terrible memory. And in order to be a good liar, you got to remember what you said to this person, this group, whatever. And he just said what was.
Right.
And on the other side of the coin in 78... Paul had an expression, and I want to make it very clear that without Paul Newman, we simply would not have won in 78 or 82. Now, Paul and I had some run-ins, and we can go into that, too, down the road, but the fact is that we would not have won without him. He's truly a genius, great ideas, and producer of television ads extraordinaire. Mm-hmm. So I give him all the credit in the world. Having said that, he had an expression of, well, let's get a release out on that and he'll have to say it. Well, you know well enough of the governor to know what kind of reaction that would have. And in fact, without my even knowledge, they did that one time in late 78 campaign. I don't know if he told you the story or not. And he called up and he was just mad as a hatter. And he had been driving in the gorge, pre-cell phone days, of course, driving down the gorge and listening to radio stations, and they were, broadcasting, and it was like a personal attack kind of thing. I mean, it was a real shot, and it was at McCall. And it might have been true if you looked at it through a political consultant's lens, but, it was not Vicatia. And he kept saying to his driver, evidently, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. And so he got back, and he called the campaign manager, and he was ready to fire everybody. And he said, "Danny, have anything to do with this?" "No. Well, let me talk to Denny," because he kept running down the staff level to see who was accountable to it. And so he's saying to me, he said, "Okay, you get a release ready. I'm firing this person, this kind of stuff." And I said, "No, you can't do that." He says, "Well, but they did. They broke the rule." And I said, "Yeah, okay." So Paul bullied him into it and so on and so forth. But we're at that point like 2 or 3 weeks out. And I said, "It's going to look like you can't keep control of your campaign staff." He said, "Well, that's evidently the case, kind of thing." And I said, "Well, we don't want that to be known. It'll really, and we're close. Let's hang in there. Things are going well," and so on and so forth. Oh, no. He was, and the stubbornness is the one word that hasn't been used here in this recent time, but I've used it a couple of times. Stubborn to a fault sometimes. And so finally I said, "Look, it was only picked up by one newspaper reporter, Doug Yoakum." Because it was inflammatory, last minute. It met all the rules for don't cover in a campaign. And I said, "I'll call Doug at home." I remember I was staying at the Mark Spencer Hotel. That was my room, just a couple blocks from the campaign. And I'm talking to him on the phone, and I'm sweating. And it's October. No, I'm sorry. It's the spring.
Yeah.
And so it's warm. And I said, "I'll call Doug, and I will fall on the sword. And I will say, Doug, that went out without authorization. The governor never said that. if you want an apology, I'll get him. You can interview him. You know, it was a complete open-faced, you can take whatever you want kind of thing mm-hmm. out of this. Mm-hmm. And Doug, bless his heart, who I sat next to at the last old-timers lunch at Lake Oswego Country Club and told mm-hmm. him the story again, he's probably tired of hearing it, said, "Ah, Denny," said, "everybody does that. I'm not going to do a follow-up story. It's stupid."
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Doug. Bye. Click. Called the governor up at home
right.
and said, he doesn't want to even touch it. He's just writing it off. You don't have to worry about anything like that. And so, yeah, that's an example of
mm-hmm.
of something. We had after the, in terms of staff doing things that he wouldn't want, Paul, we had this big meeting after the primary election. And Paul Newman is the one who was primarily speaking. But there's the governor, and here's all the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul goes into his standard, nobody has a job, you know, and this is no guarantees, and any of you can go, and along with a lot of other really hard, you know, if you don't perform, you know, and it was supposed mm-hmm. to be a pep talk.
Right. To scare the hell out of people.
Yeah. But, yeah. You know, you got Marge Russell, and you've got me, and you got people who have kind of given up their careers
yeah.
and or that have known him for years as family friend. I mean, Marge was at the family service here a couple of mm-hmm. Fridays ago, and we're all kind of going, excuse me? You know, it's not we who need him. It's him who needs we.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally the governor got a little embarrassed about the whole thing, and he kind of said, Paul, he said, there's at least one person here who's got a job, and that's me. I'm the candidate, right? I still have a job. And that broke the tension, and we all laughed, and Paul mm-hmm. kind of shrunk away at that moment. So, yeah, that happens.
Yeah.
You know, it depends on how much control the candidate. You know, candidates shouldn't run their own campaigns,
right.
period. But they don't want something that is anarchy going on in the campaign either.
Right. During the campaign, as communications director, were you involved in writing speeches?
You know, I'm not a speechwriter.
Yeah.
And the governor's not a speech deliverer.
Yeah.
And so, no.
Yeah.
I wrote position papers.
Uh-huh.
I wrote definitive little on each ballot measure and things like that. I mean, I knew his positions on the issues from traveling mm-hmm. with him a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I also did debate prep. And that mm-hmm. turned out to be something that he said modestly, was pretty good at.
Mm-hmm.
The governor hated to prepare for debates. He hated to raise money, and he thought debates were a waste of time. The media wants to see the crash on the third turn and all that kind of stuff. And so preparing him for debates was, in fact, torturous, because you had to block out time that he would just as soon be at the Malheur County Fair instead of preparing for debates. But, you know, it's the kind of thing that, again, I had some native ability, and I'd also done some research on, and so the idea of even negotiating debates in 82 about, you know, how many times do you get to be the last person to speak, and poisoning the well, and bridging from the question you're given to the one you want to answer, and, you know, some pretty straightforward debate techniques that anybody can buy a high school debate book on.
Yeah.
And so we would identify the landmines and the issues where we knew that his position wasn't... In his case, and in every successful politician's case, you do not answer based upon what the polls say.
Exactly.
Okay. Then that is just an absolute, you know, and of course he would never have done that ever under any circumstances, even if it just meant instant losing. But there is such a thing as not, you know, answering something for 5 minutes where you're just lashing yourself with sharp knives all through that period of time.
Right.
So if you're on the quote, wrong side of the issue in terms of the public, you still answer the question, but you do it in 30 seconds or 15 seconds, and you move on to something else.
Right.
And that's just smart politics. And so doing that in a debate environment, especially when you've researched the other side's
mm-hmm.
Positions, those were important aspects of that campaign. So I didn't write speeches. I responded to media inquiries. I framed issues in ways that I felt were... ones that he was comfortable with, number one, and number two would be politically successful.
Mm-hmm.
Has he told you the story about, and I can tell it from my side either way, but about Wayne Thompson and the card file?
No.
Oh, you're kidding me. Oh, Jim, no. All right. The 78 campaign was the last primarily volunteer-based statewide campaign in the history of the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
He had... a bunch of maybe 10,000 cards by the time he got out of the 74 campaign that had been kept very, very carefully by volunteers in every county. And he nurtured that. And every time he would go to an area, the notice would go out. And so these people knew him. They knew him well. They were ready to support him. We had a table as big as this, which is, what, 4x8? And it was filled with 3x5 card boxes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was impressive looking. Mm-hmm. Wayne Thompson, who'd been the sports editor and then became the political editor for the Oregonian, mm-hmm. eventually editorial writer and now retired. And so he kind of covered the horse race aspect of it, being the Blazers reporter earlier and so on. And he said, "What is this, Denny?" And I said, "Well, these are the governor's volunteers." "No, no, really. These are all, well, but they're, a lot of them are dead." And you know, this guy said, "No, actually, Marge Russell and Sharon Page, they do a very good job of keeping up on this. And mm-hmm. that we have county chairs, and in the big counties, we have multiple co-chairs, and their job is to, and this is a bullet that when loaded into the chamber and the trigger is pulled, nobody can stop us." Mm-hmm. Now, that sounded like great political rhetoric, but it actually is true.
Yeah.
And so Wayne said, "Well, all right, we agree we can test this." And I said, "Well, what kind of test do you have in mind?" He said, "Well, I want to pull at random 12 cards and call 6 people at random." I said, "Sure." So mm-hmm. he pulled 12 cards, and I don't know. I honestly can't tell you, because I didn't keep the card file, whether we got some luck or whether it was really that robust. But mm-hmm. he got 6 out of those 12 that he picked at random from his 12.
Right.
That had met him several times, saw him last time he was in town, remembered a story he told, yeah. could compare with Roger Martin and, oh, for sure, Tom McCall. And these are from all over the state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he came back and you know, it wasn't like that was a big story that turned anything. But all mm-hmm. of a sudden, in the political editor of the Oregonian's mind, we were credible.
Yeah.
We actually had this resource. We may not have enough gross rating points to go against somebody. But the fact that Tom did not raise a lot of money, and Roger really raised money, but in many ways didn't spend it very well, mm-hmm. and that we had these people literally going door to door to get out the vote. I mean, voter ID and getting out the vote with volunteers on a statewide campaign,
right.
nobody would try that now.
Yeah.
Raise millions of dollars, get a good ad agency, have a consultant, and that's the way it's done now.
Yeah.
And in 78, that was the last time it was done. We didn't even do that in 82.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Could you... do you read the New York Times?
You know, we have a deal in our house that we get the Wall Street Journal and, and the Statesman Journal and the Oregonian, and occasionally we pick up the New York Times.
There was a great article. Jimmy Carter's grandson is running for governor.
Oh, really?
And so there was a great article about that and the relationship with his grandparents.
Mm.
Because Jimmy Carter was a knock on every door person.
Right. Right.
He claims he knocked on 600,000 doors.
Right.
And the grandson is, you know, how do I, you know, keep him at arm's length and yet use all that expertise?
Yeah.
And so he says specific things on the campaign trail to say, "I'm not my grandfather."
Right, right.
You know, differences in policy. But the difference between the pre, you know, consultant era.
Right.
And the post-consultant era.
Right.
Is basically,
I mean, in 78, it was Paul Newman and David Garth. And the only real problem with Paul was that when we were down in the polls, he wasn't that available to us. When we got better in the polls, all of a sudden, he became much more available to us. Mm-hmm. And that's all consultants. They do that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think, and I've said this before, you know, especially in 82, because I was closer to it then, and I knew the mechanics of it mm-hmm. then, and I was involved in every aspect of it then. But even in 78, that the secret weapon was the fact that a lot of people who voted for Vicatia, even though in polling they might have answered, "Well, you know, he hasn't really made the Oregon economy spring back," and this again is in 82, mm-hmm. but a lot of people said, "Yeah, but I met him at the county fair, or I met him at the mm-hmm. town hall meeting. He seemed like a really honest, straightforward, cares for Oregon kind of guy," and you know, that makes a difference. It really does. And if they had ever met Tom McCall, they would say, "Wow, fiery speaker and all that kind of stuff." But he didn't have that kind of trusting, he had more of the politician right. look. And Roger, bless his soul, he was the consummate politician. I mean, he just looked, sounded, and acted like one.
Yeah.
And when it came right down to it, in those days, the polling booth, I mean, the booth, mm-hmm. the voting booth, that swung it. It really did swing it. And you could almost see that in the polling.
Yeah.
I would give him a chance. You know, he's done a good job. Let's, you know.
Yeah, so. A personal connection.
Exactly.
Just, yeah, so important. In 92, when I did my very first class where I had everybody, had all the students had to go out and volunteer for campaigns,
mm-hmm.
so Clinton's running. And Clinton had a big thing in Pioneer Courthouse Square.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my students, who was just a dying-the-wool Republican or family Republican back to Lincoln, shook his hand,
mm-hmm.
and that did it.
Yeah.
And ever since, she's been a Democratic activist.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that personal connection. Just boom.
Yeah. No question about it.
Yeah. So let's stay on campaigns to 82.
Okay.
Okay? So you're the big kahuna at this point in terms of the campaign.
Yeah. Bigger than I am now, as a matter of fact.
But one thing that the governor really impressed on me is that he governed through his entire career as if he was not running for re-election.
Right.
And that, to a certain extent, he seemed to kind of pride himself on not telling his staff if he was going to run or not, because he hadn't decided.
Mm-hmm.
And it began to drive, you know, deadlines were coming up. So was that the case in 82? As the election is coming up, did you get a sense that we need to decide this? And he hadn't yet? Because the decision was in the fall before, I believe.
Yeah, and I've got the date someplace, because in my own personal, I'm writing down as much as I can remember, because I've got some relatives who can't remember.
Right.
And so if I write it down and I read it, it'll be a fascinating story that I've never exactly. never heard before.
Exactly.
But one of the things that I have in a file is when he announced, but it was late. You're right. Mm-hmm. It was late in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of it is the wheels are coming off the state at that point.
Right, right. He's busy.
Yeah, and so it's not so much that he's worried about whether he's going to get reelected or not, because he never worried about that.
Right.
As much as we really wanted him to worry about it.
Yeah.
It came late, but you know, we were in a heap of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And not only was the state in a heap of trouble, but the governor was in a heap of trouble in 82 and even 81 and 80 in terms of special sessions and dealing with the legislature and all of that kind of stuff. And the polls were just abysmal, the public polls. Bardsley had one that showed, you know, once Kulongoski got through the primary, and you know, they were ahead of us, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So the way it operated, I think it's a fair story that enough people know that it's okay to talk about it now, is that Sharon Page ran the primary,
mm-hmm.
and we had a no-name bunch of opponents,
mm-hmm.
but we got 83%. And so the way I talk about it today is nearly one in five primary voters picked none of the above.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Bill Patrick or, you know, somebody's right. name, $200 on a voter pamphlet page, and that's all they had going for them. And that's a scary thing in a primary,
mm-hmm.
very scary. Bob Straub used to do that in Democratic primaries as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so going into that, there's a group that I refer to as the influentials.
Mm-hmm.
And the influentials in Governor Attia's circle were those people who sometimes were benign, sometimes they were toxic, sometimes they were very caring and loving and supportive and loyal to him,
mm-hmm.
but they all kind of wanted to work around the system and whisper in his ear and things like that. And the business community, for example, as I think I said on Straight Talk the other night, you know, it's something I wrote for a Capital newsletter. It's all blending together.
Mm-hmm.
But I can remember lots of times when the so-called business community was in the Board of Control room, the conference room down there in the governor's suite, and they were just fighting mad at him because he wasn't doing what they were trying to tell him to do.
Right.
Now, when your political survival is at stake, there's a whole lot of throat cutting outside of the corner office that's mm-hmm. going on. Everybody doesn't want to take any blame for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And you can read in Straub's thing when they decided that, you know, Ken Phobe should go second press secretary to Bob Straub. It'll come to me. TV reporter, Channel 12. Anyway, I've got a cartoon that says, take him first. They're going to the French Inquisition and the guillotine is around the corner. Mm-hmm. It says, take him first. He was our PR guy. And so there was a lot of pressure on me at that point as to whether or not I was ever going to even have a job, let alone anything else. And I was running the Western Governors Conference and so on. Well, we came away from the primary night party having met someone who had been highly recommended to us by one of the, quote, influentials, one of those people who thought that they were very powerful, as going to be the campaign manager in 82. Mm-hmm. And it was clear from his behavior that night to everyone that that wasn't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tell the story. I'm driving back down the freeway with my wife, Holly. Governor Dolores and Lon are driving back, and Jerry without Al, because Al decided to wait out, didn't need to go to that party kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're all thinking the same thing, only Jerry's thinking, God, Denny be perfect. The governor's thinking, I think Denny would be great. I wonder if he'll be willing to do it. I'm thinking, my career's over. You know, mm-hmm. if I accept this job, this is a losing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where the wheels are coming off not only the state, but also the campaign right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling Holly this. And she said, well, then what are your choices? I said, well, if I stay, I'm going to be take him first. He's our PR guy. Blame the messenger kind of thing. And that was lining up. Because other staff who might have had some reason to be blamed, you know, wanted to have somebody there. So I'm
right.
I'm really just in a total, I'm going to lose everything here and the end of my career, period.
Mm-hmm.
I was somewhat despondent. Well, then there was a meeting, and we went to the meeting, and Blake Herring, who, bless his soul, great fundraiser, great leader, and he pretty much, you know, said, look, well, this guy's not going to work out, so it's got to be Denny. And mm-hmm. and I said, well, okay, and I made just really a couple of rules, and then later I had a private meeting with the governor, and I said, no. I said, you know, it's a Gethsemane prayer. If this could pass,
yeah.
let it pass kind of thing. I just yeah. assumed not do it. And then he pulled out the do it for me line, mm-hmm. and I said, I can't say no to that. He said, no. I know you can't say no to that. That's why I'm putting it that way. So then I said, okay, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, I got just a couple of rules. Okay, what is it? And I said, I got to have a free hand once we get the plan put together. I don't want people having private meetings. I don't want people second guessing it. I don't want people coming to you and saying, you know, well, Denny's doing a terrible job because he didn't do it my way. And he said, you know my style. I hire good people. We get a plan. We put it together. I leave them alone unless there's a problem. And then you come to me and we'll solve. You know, it's just mm-hmm. the same way he ran state government.
Right.
And I said, that's fine. I said, then I've got, you know, one other requirement. And I already had that agreement, by the way, with the executive committee, with all mm-hmm. the people who were really going to do things, who were really cared about him. And the second one was a private one with the governor. And that is, there'll be no private meetings with the consultant. And he said, well, what do you mean? And again, this is a classic consultant gambit, and I've seen it, never used it, but I've seen it several times in other campaigns that I was either a debate coach for or I was involved on the periphery, even as a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
There would be an argument, and the argument with the consultant was the consultant wanted to do something that was totally bizarre and totally un-Oregon and counter to what the governor would, or the candidate, if it was the earlier campaign, would have wanted to do. And the consultant says, well, I'll meet with the candidate privately tonight, and then we'll get together tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Well, it always came out his way,
yeah.
you know, because you don't have a chance to make the counter-argument. And so I said, that just isn't going to happen. Because I said, I'm going to be one of those who everybody's going to look to as being responsible. And if somebody else is, you know, calling some shot that I really should be calling, I don't mind losing an argument, but I want to be in the argument.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of looked at me, well, of course, you know. Close off the loop on the story, it was 30 days later when the consultant said, you know, I'll meet privately with the governor tonight and we'll talk about this in the morning. I said, I'll see you there. And he said, no, you won't. I'm meeting with him privately. I said, yes, you will. That's my arrangement. And, I mean, we're in a 30-person meeting and he's standing up and I'm standing up and we're starting to yell at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back to the campaign office and wrote my resignation letter.
Mm-hmm.
Slipped it under the door of the Hilton Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And at 2 in the morning, the governor calls me and says, what do you need from me? What do you want? And I said, I don't want any private meetings with the consultant. We already agreed to that. He said, tomorrow will be our last one. Now, did the governor meet with Paul Newman privately in the rest of the 1982 campaign? Yeah, probably.
Mm-hmm.
On the phone or maybe even mm-hmm. in a hotel. But was the consultant ever able to come to me and said, I've met with the governor and this is what he has decided? No.
Mm-hmm.
That was now off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, coming through with that arrangement was a key to being
yeah.
able to do the job as campaign manager. So I digressed. Bring me back on track, Professor.
No, you're doing great. let's stick with the 82 campaign.
Okay.
We've got a lot of stuff, and I've talked to you before about this, and the governor goes into it in great detail, and I've talked to him about it, about Ted Kulongoski being a dangerous guy.
Right.
So tell us for the record what was going on with that. Because I'm going to go back, I mean, there's a perception thing here, and so I'm going to go back and be reading the media pretty carefully and, you know, seeing that kind of stuff as well.
Well, I'll just tell you that I've got the binder.
Cool.
I have every single ad that we produced.
Right.
And I brought it with me to the so-called post-mortem at the Benson Hotel. Mm-hmm. Michael Murphy did not, I think that was his name, the manager that Ted brought in. And so they immediately brought that up kind mm-hmm. of thing. And I said, we never called him dangerous. Mm-hmm. We called his policies dangerous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, who in their right mind would name a bill the plant closure bill? Mm-hmm. You know, he supported the plant closure bill. Well, that's not what it did, but wouldn't you, if you were running against somebody, say mm-hmm. he supported the plant closure bill?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we never called him dangerous. We called his policies dangerous. Did people conclude that that meant that he was dangerous? Yeah, I mean, we were not stupid, mm-hmm. but we didn't call him dangerous. Now, maybe mm-hmm. that's a fine line, especially if you're talking to Governor Kulongoski, mm-hmm. but for us it was really important. Now, for the record, Bob Packwood, who I don't think has had the reintroduction kind of friendship with Governor Kulongoski right. that Governor Attia had, he called him dangerous in a letter he sent out because he decided that he was dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't, you know, something that we were responsible for. So, yeah, we were very careful there. And then we were accused of negative campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
And I was ready. I had all these quotes from Jermon Whitcomb, the two guys who wrote the political column, mm-hmm. now dead.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I said, you got to define negative campaigning for me.
Mm-hmm.
If negative campaigning is saying something true, but is basically saying something true about your opponent that makes the opponent look bad, if that's negative campaigning, then Ted did it first kind of thing. And I had all of their ads, too, of course, that we'd, you know, gotten copies of. But that's not negative campaigning, and that's fair game.
Yeah,
if,
absolutely.
In fact, you say something that's not true and it's negative about the person, that could be considered negative campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
There's another school of thought that says if you do nothing but say bad things about your opponent, you can't win. And I kind of agree with that. I mean, you've got to have your base of support that's the positive side to people to go to. You can't
right.
just bring the negatives up or bring that candidate down. So we did a lot of that as well, especially
mm-hmm.
early on.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't bring out the things that the voters don't like about someone, then you're only running half a campaign.
Right.
So, yeah, we didn't call him dangerous. We called his policies dangerous. They were, as far
mm-hmm.
as I was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
The governor believed it, and that moved numbers.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back a little bit to the your comment about TN debates. He didn't like them, didn't really see the point of them.
Yeah.
He's very clear about that. He was clear about, when we talked, he was clear about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
It hits me to my political scientist wanting to have debates heart. But what you just said, you've got to give the voters something to vote for, as well as something to compare against.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's standard now.
Right.
It's absolutely standard. But the debate thing, I mean, one reason that, from my point of view, debates are good is because there's a small chance, the people who run the debates are not very good, but there's a small chance that you'll get the candidates off of their talking points.
Mm-hmm.
And in no other way are you going to do that. And so when the governor was saying, well, we had other ways of doing that, I was thinking to myself, and at one point I did ask, so you just want me to hear your recipe? You know, I never get to know you. I never get to know these other things. From your point of view as campaign manager, and then from your point of view as political consultant, how valuable is it for the voters to see a candidate who's not in control of their message, who has to respond to things that they haven't thought of as deeply as the things that they're really focusing on in the campaign?
Well, in the case of Vic Attia, the 20 years in the legislature just trumped a whole lot in the primary, and for that matter in the general election of 78 and in 82 as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because as bright a guy as Ted Kulongoski is, he'd been in the legislature for, what, I don't even remember, 4 years or 3 years or
yeah.
something like that. And yeah, he'd been and that's the other thing he didn't like. We called him a union lawyer
right.
rather than a labor attorney.
Right.
Well, I mean, you sit in a room and you say, okay, what sounds bad?
yeah.
And it's still accurate.
Yeah.
Well, union lawyer sounds bad and labor attorney sounds really distinguished.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's one thing versus another. But anyway, they everyone he ran against in the time that I worked on his campaigns in 78 and in 82 were people who really either had a somewhat superficial understanding of the issues and would not be ready to answer something that was of a technical nature or an informational level. And in the case of Bob Straub and Tom McCall, it was because they, as you say, in management school, flew at 50,000 feet
right.
and just simply looked and had the staff deal with the minutia. Thank you, Professor. And so they really, beyond, and McCall right. just went on and on and on about all of his accomplishments, and he knew about that because he'd been bragging about himself forever. Right. And that looked bad, and he really didn't answer the questions. And Roger knew most of the issues, but was caustic and mean and all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, you have a real ace in the hand when, in fact, you've got someone who knows the issues that well. Because if you don't prepare for them, he'll still have knowledge of that issue.
Right.
And will be able to say, I worked on that 10 years ago. And by the way, I was the chair of the committee. And, you know, on and on. Or never a chair of a committee, but that you know, it was in that position to have an influence on it. And so made it kind of easy. Really, we focused on, in a political debate, you can anticipate, I think, 85 to 90% of the questions.
Easily.
Yes. And if you can't, you can have an answer for the other 5 to 10% of mm-hmm. the questions that's close enough.
Mm-hmm.
And you can prepare for that. So they're really not off-message,
mm-hmm.
I don't think. Now, flubbing, you know,
right.
Free Poland, and, you know, you can go through all of the classic, you know, you're no Jack Kennedy, and, I mean, I got all the books. Those are the books, and moving to a smaller area for books here the first of the year, I kept all of those.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I still have a book on the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which were not debates, as I'm sure you know.
Yeah, exactly.
They were long speeches, but... You can always move to an area that is more comfortable for you,
mm-hmm.
even if you have to say, you know, that's something I'm still working on, but you know that's similar to, and then
exactly.
immediately move to something else. You just have to be willing to do that. And with the governor, it was relatively easy if he just sat down and said, okay, you got to do this in 30 seconds,
mm-hmm.
and by the way, you've got to leave it so that the other person is left hanging because you've just socked them, and because you were the person who answered last.
Right.
I mean, we'd have different practice answers for known questions, whether you answered first or whether you answered last or whether you did a rebuttal or wherever it was, because it's a technical process. And
right.
the taste you leave in the voter's mouth that are interested, and most people who are watching debates are really eager to be interested. They want to know
mm-hmm.
what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very narrow audience, but
exactly.
except for the mistakes and so on. So, yeah, it was... He didn't like to do it, but when he did it and he came out, there was one, he probably told you the story, but he came out of one of those in 82. He came out of it, one of them, and they said, wow, people said you even had charisma.
Yes.
And he goes, you should have told me. I didn't know you wanted charisma.
Oh,
I'll give you charisma, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And when you look at the real definition of charisma, he had it in spades.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the guy was charismatic in the true meaning of that word. Not
right.
flashy at all, but with incredible charisma.
Yeah. People came around him.
Yeah.
And liked to be there.
Yep.
Liked to be part of that.
Yep.
So what you just described sounds different than what he was describing about not liking debates. Did he have that kind of loose style, I can talk about anything, when he was out on the campaign trail?
Yeah, and he could.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was not for him something that he felt like he needed to prepare for.
Right.
But in a debate environment, you're not in a town hall meeting in Fossil.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you're in a very structured environment, and you've got people who are looking for gotchas, and your opponent's looking for gotchas. The media's looking for gotchas.
Yeah.
You know, they're hoping for the crash in the third turn, as the boss used to say. And so you do have to prepare for that, and it is a relatively high risk kind of environment.
Okay.
So, in 80s,
so more the fishbowl aspect of it.
Yeah,
and again,
in Fossil, you can go on for 5 or 6 minutes on a subject and do a follow up, and nobody's out to cut your throat.
Right.
But in a debate environment, that's what it's all about, is cutting throats.
Yeah.
In 82, when I had some control over the debate process, we had a strategy going into the, first of all, we challenged Kulongoski to debate on election night.
Election night, right.
And second of all, we were negotiating with his law partner, I can't think of his name right now, who was a union lawyer, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He was a negotiator. And I was just a PR guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it was all set up. And I had conversations with a lot of people about this, so it's no big secret. I went in, and they started talking about, well, we're going to have, you know, 20 debates, and we're going to do this and that, because he wasn't as well known as Governor Attia was, mm-hmm. and so on. And so more debates was good. And I said, well, I'm hopeful that we don't have any. Well, but your guy challenged. I said, I understand that, but my negotiating position was, create an impasse if you can here, because I would love to go back and say, I'm sorry, but they don't agree, and we've created an impasse. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they were just kind of shocked at this. And I said, you know, I'll negotiate in what you guys like to call good faith, because I've been told by my boss to do that. But I feigned, I hope this fails.
Mm-hmm.
You know, please send me in the briar patch kind mm-hmm. of thing. You know, this mm-hmm. failing is the best thing that could possibly happen here. So, and we agreed up front that nobody would talk about what we talked about in those negotiating sessions, and we agreed up front that we would control it. We wouldn't let the League of Women Voters control it or KGW control it, that we would be the ones making decisions on format mm-hmm. and location and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was pretty much set. I hope it fails. Well, we came up with actually exactly what we wanted
mm-hmm.
as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
And because they were really, really needing to have debates. They yeah. had to hit a home run. And the format was fair. It was not overbalanced one way or the other. The locations, what Portland, Eugene, Medford, were, mm-hmm. were, you know, I kept pushing for Bend or, you mm-hmm. know, Pendleton or something like that. But they, you know, they gave up like a second Portland debate for that. And mm-hmm. but in the end, we had exactly really what we wanted
yeah.
as far as the strategy was concerned.
Yeah. So let's shift from campaigning, which is mm-hmm. always good fun, to the actual things that governors do.
Mm-hmm.
They govern.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I was asked when the governor died is, what would his governorship have been like without the recessions?
Mm-hmm.
And the sense that I get is it would have been a pro-business administration, but pro-business, he was extremely worried about moral hazard. The idea that if you have too much government, people will just kind of expect government to fill in those holes.
Mm-hmm.
But he realized that there was a strong role for government for people who are in need of things, for land use. He's very eloquent on that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just talking about watching Canyon Road change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a strong role for government there. So mm-hmm. it didn't make it into any of the obits that were on the air or anything, I don't think.
No, the obits were hijacked by dealing with the economy and
right. Just I did a the OPB Think Out Loud one, which is mm-hmm. 10.5 minutes of unadulterated stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure. I don't think they asked the question. But but my sense it would have been an administration that worked on making it so that job creators could create jobs, people, consumers were protected within, you know, reason. But it would have been a moderate pro-business administration. But then the recessions hit, and so there's all sorts of things that hit that he has to respond to. You know, we've cut these things, now we have to raise taxes. You know, all these kinds of things happen. So what is your sense of kind of what would have been without, you know, the kitchen sink and Rajneeshis?
Counterfactual yeah. history question.
And, huh? And the reason I ask is, when I asked him what he wanted to accomplish, he really gave the impression that he was a blank slate. You know, he'd had all this experience. He wanted to run when Tom was retiring, because he said, you know, I can do that. But he didn't come in with, boy, you know, in 1964 we dealt with this. I don't think we dealt with it the right way. We need to change that. None of that was really there. He saw himself as a competent administrator who could be governor.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he eventually becomes governor.
Well, let's talk generic political philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
With or without the recession, I'm mm-hmm. going to start with that. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm using a debate technique here and bridging to what I want to say. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But he certainly believed there was an appropriate role for government in general.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a libertarian streak that there was a whole lot of things that government was involved in that it didn't need to be
right.
involved in.
Right.
And that they were costing a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And fiscal conservative, Socially, I think even again, this the name and the labels don't do much justice to anything, but really pretty much liberal or libertarian in that regard. I mean, you look at his views on diversity and discrimination and and the fact that the most bills that he introduced as a legislator were human resource bills and, and things like that. So he talked about often, and hopefully he's talked to you about this as well so you can quote him and not me, but you know, coming up with carefully judging the essential versus the desirable.
Right.
And it was his view that there are there is an infinite supply of desirable things out there. And if government does it, that means somebody else is paying for it in a lot of people's minds. And even if it's appropriate for government to do it, what happens is that in good times, before the kicker came in good times, all these desirable things would get latched into place. And then in bad times, they couldn't get rid of them, even though the revenue dropped. So you'd have to raise revenue in order to keep paying for them. And that ratchet would continue to grow. And I think one of his goals was to look at everything kind of, and they use the phrase, you know, the base budgeting and all that kind of thing. Well, or zero-based budgeting. Nobody ever really did that. But but he sort of did. And his direct involvement in that process made a huge difference. The story about him being in the actual budget meetings. Okay, so you heard that one. Good. It shocked the hell out of some agency people who walked into these meetings expecting to see John Yunker and Bob Smith, and all of a sudden here was Vic Atiyah and Lee Johnson and you know, whoa, kind of thing. And he said the story about the, whatever it was, $60,000. And the guy said, well, Governor, it's only $60,000. And he said, well, excuse me, if that was in your bank account or not in your bank account, it would make a difference, wouldn't it? And okay, so now we're talking. And getting into that minutia and making those decisions, I'll go so far as to even say that the recession actually helped him get that stuff done. Because if it hadn't been for the recession, working with a Democratic legislature the entire 8 years, if we'd have had a whole lot of money, it would have been much more difficult for him to have screwed things down and and cut things that were really maybe desirable, maybe not, but certainly some people thought they were desirable or they wouldn't be there. Since then, it's of course just gone gone the other way. But during, during you can only do what you can do during your time there. We would go to these Western governors meetings and during the recession and we would talk to people from Alaska, staff. Staff would always get together, have a few drinks, swap lies, hopefully learn something. And they would say to us, oh, we wish we had your problem. Well, what do you mean? We're cutting people. We've got high end, we're just that and something else. Of course, they had more money than anything. They were giving money.
Oil crises.
Boom. They were giving money to citizens rather than taking money from citizens. And we said, why would you want our problems? Because we can't say no. You can say no. You have every reason to say no. And if we just had something like that, it would make it so much easier to govern if we could say no. So I guess one premise would be that the recession in some ways helped. It was too deep, however, to lean on that and say, oh, that was a good thing, you know, because it wasn't a good thing. People were suffering. Industries were changing. A lot of things were happening as a result of that. But there was at least a more positive side. I mean, if you're dealing with Grattan Cairns and Ed Fadley and John Kitzhaber and Vera Katz and so on, and they're not, you know, well, let's get rid of this entire program. You know, they wouldn't even think about doing that if there weren't in a situation where the budget had to balance in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So
that really comes out strongly with the 84 special session on the unitary tax. I'm going to be fascinated to talk to people who were there because, and it makes perfect sense. His impression was that the legislature really didn't have any clue what a unitary tax was.
Yeah, the unitary method of taxation.
Right, and so
kind of like
doing
plant closing, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And in my notes, I'm not doing repeal. I'm doing replacement of unitary.
Right, tax. It was just a change.
It's just a change. It was injected in there that this was economic development. And that worked with the people, that worked with the legislature. And so one day session, you know, there's I can't remember what the other economic thing was that came up in that time. There was one other economic thing that was during that one day session. But whatever it was, you know, it was economic development.
I got a file. We can look it up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But that, when in political science, it's called you're not only setting the agenda, but you're setting the parameters within which things can happen.
Right.
And the recession, in effect, provided that.
Right. Yeah, it was, the same thing for the safe raid.
Right.
Can you, on the recording, can you hear air quotes
exactly.
around the word raid?
Exactly.
It turned out it was. You know, we thought we were, the Attorney General said it was okay. A bank of lawyers say it's okay. Supreme Court, X number of years later, says we stole it.
Yeah.
Interestingly, of course, that was the last of three special sessions in the election year.
Right.
During the campaign.
Right.
And the treasurer of our campaign was Roy Livermore, who was on the board of SAFE and was just hopping mad
mm-hmm.
that we were going to do that. And it was dead wrong and all. And I'm dealing with him virtually every other day.
Yeah.
And he buried that. And he said, we'll get through this campaign, then we'll have that fight. And he won it. And he reminded me of it, that he won it. And, you know, that was the end of that.
Yeah.
So, but, yeah, you get we're kind of switching back to campaign time because you tend to remember those stories. But.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Thompson calls me up, and I've got the date in my file over here, but you can look it up. And she said, Denny, we need another special session.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Jerry, you know, we're just, the numbers are looking good and all this kind of stuff. And she said, well, it's going to be a one-day session. And I said, you know, she explained it to me. And you talk about setting the parameters. Well, here's what, when you add up the numbers, you know, half of the body in one house is running and all of the body in the other house is running and the governor's running and there's other people who are running and you know, they have to balance the budget so that we pretty much cut everything we can cut. Here's a revenue source that appears to be painless. Bang. It was, yes. You know, I don't know how many people voted against it, but it wasn't very many.
Yeah.
And
I think the governor counted six.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and everybody didn't show up.
Yeah. So. We ran the other way, basically.
Exactly.
So, I really think in terms of his philosophy that everybody says, you know, he was tailor-made for governing during the recession, and that's probably true. But if the recession had not been there, there's maybe the possibility that there, you know, some of the numbers were fairly close in terms mm-hmm. of elected politics and Dr. No, as they called Kitzhaber at the time, outdid us, I think, on record number of vetoes. Mm-hmm. But when we had Larry Campbell in the House, who was willing to even, he had discipline of his House members. And so he would say to them, even though you don't want to uphold the governor's veto on this because you're on the other side of the issue, once we lose that ability to threaten a veto, we've lost all our power as a minority. So you stand firm and we'll count noses and see who's most vulnerable politically and we'll let you go. And, you know, that's the way it's done. And we were successful in being able to threaten that situation. Do it better, do it different, bring it back to me and you'll get a signature. If not, you're going to get the veto.
Mm-hmm.
And that made it work.
One of the things when he talks about vetoes, because I think that was the 33 veto session. But he talks about prioritizing in his own mind, what is he willing to go on the mat for?
Mm-hmm.
What's, you know, it'd be great to have, but, you know, one way or the other. One of the vetoes got overridden, and that was, you know, he didn't feel that strongly about
right.
it. but, so talk about being inside his office. Was he clear on what those priorities were? Or was that in his own head?
It was in his head primarily, but you could tell, you could analyze his vetoes. And if we laid them out here in front of, I could probably even put three classifications on them. They mm-hmm. were bills that were, at least in his mind and the mind of some legal experts and so on, just technically flawed,
right.
you know, and that was just bad legislation and it needed to go away.
Yeah.
And those didn't get overridden in general. There were the serious, major, philosophical, benchmark kind of issues at the top end of those that
mm-hmm.
he would even fight to keep them from being overridden. I mean, we would lobby them just like we would lobby a bill mm-hmm. with the legislature. And then there are ones you're kind of talking about in the middle of, you know, this just isn't good. You know, and mm-hmm. I've got one vote, but it's the big vote.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to exercise it because I can.
Yeah.
And some of those got overridden.
Yeah.
But none of the first category and a few of the big ones and some more of that middle category. From my perspective, when you're talking to me, some of this kind of depends on which sessions you're talking about.
Right.
Because early on, I was simply not in the loop.
Yeah.
I was just out of it
yeah.
because of internal politics. And then later, obviously, I was much more involved, much more directly involved, but still not as a policy person. I mean, mm-hmm. my job was to communicate and to facilitate communication more than anything else. Mm-hmm. I've always felt from a public relations standpoint, and I learned this from Sam Bailey, head of the Department of Information at Oregon State University, one of my mentors. Mm-hmm. His mentor, Fred Scheidler, was actually one of the very first press secretaries. He was press secretary to...
Dick Smith.
To Elmo Smith.
Yeah, Elmo.
Yeah. Yeah. And
you could never understand why people wouldn't support Denny. Have you met Denny? Well, he's a nice boy. He's not a boy anymore.
Yeah, right.
He's grown up. He's no Elmo.
He's grown up. And that is that communications and public relations is not taking something that is bad that you've done or you're doing or whatever and trying to gloss it over and make mm-hmm. it into something good. It's, in fact, taking something that you're doing and communicating it well and getting it out there and taking your best shot at something like that. The second basic principle is that the, quote, PR guy, which has a negative mm-hmm. connotation, but the mm-hmm. communications person, needs to be involved in the decisions.
Right.
Because sometimes there's three right things within a decision, but one of them is easier to deal with on a communications level, and one of them is impossible to deal with on a communications level. And mm-hmm. so you want to be there at the table arguing that. Well, pretty much, I don't know, I got to get the chart out and find out when Lee left, but pretty much at least halfway through Lee Johnson's term mm-hmm. as executive assistant, I was the guy they'd walk in and hand me the position paper and say, get a release out on that. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until later that I was involved, and I got more involved for a couple of reasons. I don't know if you want to go down this path at this point or not, but
I'll... No, I do, because I mean, I want to hit Lee and those dynamics as much as I can, because the governor glosses over him.
Yeah, at least he's very kind.
Yeah, he's very kind, and the most he did is he felt that. He said to me, and he said on the OHS thing, I felt that Lee wanted to be the governor.
He's much more comfortable in an environment where he's in charge.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And it's like, but Lee states for a long time.
Yeah. Let's back up. First of all, the governor's right in terms of that, and, mm-hmm. and he's not always right. Okay. when he wanted to blow up the sign, he wasn't right. Although
yes.
he would say to me right now, I was right, and I should have done it. But anyway, so he's not always right. And when
he has Paul Lemon and a whale next to it, then I think it might have worked.
Well, that was my argument against it. I mean, did he tell you the whole story about that? I mean,
I did not interview him about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
I've got all the stuff that he did.
So you hold the Lee Johnson thought for just a moment. All right. This is the appropriate time.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to, this is.
A little comic relief.
Yeah. Well, and just scared the whatever's out of me. This is one of those things that is so crystal clear in my mm-hmm. mind, because I've retold the story so many times, right. and it hasn't changed since the first time I told it. And to his dying day, the governor disagrees with me mm-hmm. on this decision. But he comes into my office and lights up a cigarette, which, you know, everybody in that office smoked but me. And he said, Denny, you know that sign we're going to tear down at the California border with Tom? Yeah. He said, well... All right, so we want to get a lot of coverage on that, right? And I said, absolutely, Governor. And you know, by the time it was actually happened, I was up at the campaign. But, mm-hmm. And he said, okay. And then Tom stole the show, as would be expected. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, we're going to blow it up with dynamite. My eyes get big, and I said, oh, yeah, right. You know, okay. So anyway, no, we're going to blow it up with dynamite. And I said, so you remember the whale? You know, another state explosion, as
right.
it were. And then I quickly pulled out, because one of our very first speechwriters was Larry Sturholm, who wrote mm-hmm. the book on the D'Aftermath brothers. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you realize that that location is, as the crow flies, about 3 miles from another mm-hmm. terrible, gone bad explosion mm-hmm. that killed people and so on and so forth? And I said, this thing is just fraught with disaster. And he said, look, and his phrase was that, what was the sheriff show where the southern sheriff would go, handle it. Handle it. And that became code. He didn't have to even say the words. He would just be sitting in his office or someplace else, and he would look at a staff member and go, and that didn't mean get out of here. That meant make it happen.
Right.
Make it happen. So he says, I'm going to Portland. Just uh-huh. like that. Flipped his fingers, and not the finger, but fingers. And he left, and I just am going, oh, man. I probably didn't say man. I probably said something much worse.
Mm-hmm.
And the phone rings. It's Jerry Thompson. She's, Denny, my office, now. Yes, ma'am. Stood up, walked down the office. In her office, the superintendent of state police, head of the military department, the head of emergency services, Bob Oliver, the governor's legal assistant. Who am I missing here? I mean, Department of Transportation head. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the affected parties are there. And the first word out of her mouth was, you've got to talk the governor out of this. And I said, okay, give me some help here. Well, they started off, you know, we have to close Interstate 5. You can't really do that. Mm-hmm. Well, I said, they close it all the time for road work. No, not for this. You can't do it all the time. There are specified federal rules and regulations. The National Guard says, you know, they don't give us those kinds of things. You know, we don't get to have explosives. They may give us some ammunition to practice shooting. And it went on and on and on. And eventually we did talk him out of it. And, of course, again, Tom got all the good quotes right. out of it anyway, and that's going to happen. But the sign got changed.
Yeah.
And we didn't, you know, have a hillside come sliding down on Interstate 5 right. or people getting shrapneled or whatever the case might be.
Exactly.
Right. So
built, destroyed by governor.
Oh, yeah, no. just and again, the two classic cases are the Whale and the D'Atramont brothers. And how ironic that you can get the tunnel number, whatever it is,
yeah.
just a short distance away yeah. from that border position.
Absolutely.
Oh, scary. Absolutely. Very scary. Okay, Lee Johnson.
Lee Johnson.
The governor's elected, and one of the things that Travis Cross, who was our consultant, or not consultant, he was the transition officer. He was the one mm-hmm. who was leading the transition. He said, I'm really surprised that Vic doesn't have a long list of people that he wants to get into positions.
Yeah.
And I said, well, to my knowledge, you know, number one, they didn't expect him to win. And number two, that's not his style. You know, we shortly after that took the question of what's your political party off of any application forms for boards and commissions right. or staff or anything else. And hired a tremendous number of Democrats, kept some of Straub's people on board. And so with the executive assistant, first of all, Lynn Newberry, I think, would have been his first choice, but Lynn made the very, very specific comment early on, I'll help you because I think you're wonderful and I this, that, and something else. Do not ask me to be executive assistant slash chief of staff. I'm too busy down here to do that.
Mm-hmm.
His next choice, I think it's clear. Now, he may or may not have said this, but I believe it's clear just based on having been there at the time, was Jerry Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent Travis up to talk to Jerry. And Jerry eventually said no, much to the chagrin of her husband. You know, you don't say no to the governor kind mm-hmm. of thing, but she was at a very critical point with the merger of OPS and Blue Cross and all that kind of stuff, and it was just literally would have been incredibly irresponsible for her and her family for her to, mm-hmm. to take that position. I don't know how many other people were on that list,
mm-hmm.
but Lee was not obviously a first choice or probably not even a second or third choice. Mm-hmm. But now, having said that, Lee, in his defense, incredibly bright guy. I mean, I think we're talking Stanford and Ivy League and, mm-hmm. you know, old money kind of education and great, if they had SATs back then, I mean, probably perfect scores and that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. Tremendous governmental experience coming into the position, knew what was going on, knew state government. But unfortunately, really probably would have been better at being governor than being chief of staff.
Mm-hmm.
And also, unfortunately, he took the model for chief, and this is my opinion, obviously all this is my opinion, mm-hmm. he took the model for chief of staff from previous governors, specifically McCall and Straub,
right.
where there was a very strong executive assistant, Bob Davis, you know, you can look those up kind of thing, but those are people who pretty much ran state government.
Mm-hmm.
And the governors, again, flew at 50,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know enough about Vicatia to know that he didn't. He, in fact, was at 50,000 feet, but at the same time, miraculously, he was down at ground level
right.
checking on the troops. And so it was very frustrating because he never really got that. And he tells the story, and if he hasn't already told it, I'll make it very brief and you can do follow-up. But both Lee Johnson and Lynn Newberry, during the transition or right afterwards as they're going through the budget, and they say, well, here's what we're going to do, and they laid it all out. And he just sits there and listens to them laying it all out, and then he says, okay, well, we're not going to do that. We're going to do it this way.
Right.
And he saw it as chief of staff and not as the chief operating officer of the state. He was the chief operating officer as well as the CEO
yeah.
of the state. And Lee never got that. Also, Lee ended up bringing in a lot of people who he knew because there was a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
I would never have been hired as press secretary had I not been hired the day after the campaign ended.
Mm-hmm.
And that was close as it was, because once you win, all these people come out of the woodwork, you know, that have mm-hmm. bigger resumes and better background and all that kind of stuff. And I, you know, said, I've earned this. I've earned a chance to show you I can do it. And the governor said, you're right. And that's how I got hired.
Mm-hmm.
But Lee had other people who would have been more loyal to Lee than they would have been to the governor, who were in those kinds of positions. And so, yeah, it was not until we started the media availabilities that I began to have a little more influence. And the governor, right away, the media says they're not getting enough coverage, not getting enough access. That's just a standard thing. There's always a meeting at the beginning of every administration where the dean of the press corps comes up and says, we need more access, we need more coverage. No matter how much they're getting,
mm-hmm.
they need more. So they did. And so the governor calls me in and says, how are we going to deal with this? Well, that's how the so-called media availability came about. And I think I've told you before that I think that was the first time that term was ever used. Mm-hmm. News conference, obviously, is when you have something to say.
Right.
You take the responsibility for it being newsworthy. Media availability is, I'm here. You got questions? Anything you want to ask is fine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was a governor. I mean, I don't know about the Hatfield administration, but certainly from McCall to the current governor, there only one really can handle that level of questioning, where you don't know what you're going to hear, you don't know what question you're going right. to get, and 99% of the time you've got an answer for it.
Yeah.
But it still, just like debates, required some preparation.
Yeah.
And so I was the guy who prepared him. And if it was nothing more than reading the paper and making him aware that this is something that, thinking like a reporter. And so then we would talk about an issue, and I would say, so where are you on that?
Mm-hmm.
And he would say something, and I'd say, yeah, but do you realize? And then I would bring in other information from other sources, not my personal opinion,
mm-hmm.
but just other things that I had picked up from the papers mm-hmm. or from the TV or from any number of sources, talking to people. And he'd go, I wasn't aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sorry, that was Lee's job or yeah. another assistant to the governor to make sure he knew about that. And so they were Lee and other assistants would, if they wanted to get a certain answer out of the governor or a certain position out of the governor, they weren't doing what I think is good staff work, which is to present him with all sides
right.
and let him decide. They were lobbying him rather than providing him with information. So then he would go back to Lee and say, Lee, what about this, this, this? Oh, yeah, but don't worry about that. You know. And so he was losing credibility and I was gaining access. And it was about halfway through Lee's tenure that then Lee would come into my office and sit down and say, oh, Denny, we really need to have you on board on this one and help us with the governor kind of thing. And I'd say, well, don't start off with that. Tell me what you're talking about here, and then we'll see, you know, mm-hmm. whether this fits what we're trying to do communication-wise mm-hmm. and so on. And that led to more and more, you know, sort of direct involvement in, mm-hmm. in policy matters. But I didn't have to go talk to legislators, and I didn't have to. Jerry said no, and Lee was supposed to business people and legislators and elected officials, and I was the one that had to say no or deliver bad mm-hmm. news to everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the time, if you go back in the clippings in the room down the end of the hall here, mm-hmm. you'll see my name associated with bad news or bad things. And of course, when it's good news, you have the boss
right.
announce it, and that's yeah. fine. That's it's in your job description.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was frustrated with Lee, I think, 2 months in,
mm-hmm.
and he has a tremendous amount of loyalty to someone and wants to give them a chance. And that's the up the creek without a paddle award. I mean, you take mm-hmm. risks and I'll stick with you. But it finally got to the point where he just couldn't stick with him that long.
Yeah.
And went to Jack Faust and said, you know, talk to Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And, you know, Lee was much happier after that. And by the way, Lee was incredibly loyal to the governor. The other way around, was involved in the 82 campaign, was on the steering committee,
mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until, you know, he was a circuit judge again,
mm-hmm.
where circuit judges rule in their own courtroom, and they have that dominion and that domain, that he was really a happy camper.
Yeah.
And, again, very talented, well knowledgeable about things, knew mm-hmm. about politics, all these kinds of things, just didn't understand the role that Governor Attia had in mind for a chief of staff. And Jerry Thompson did understand that role, and even she got bit a couple of times,
mm-hmm.
you know, and she'd have to say, you know, she'd say, no, Governor, I briefed you on this. Here's the notes, remember? And he would have forgotten about it, but he was mm-hmm. kind of almost scarred or wounded mm-hmm. from the experience with Lee that it made it much more difficult for anyone who was going to follow that, because it was really I am the governor time.
Yeah.
And soon that wasn't a problem at all, because he understood that Jerry was in fact doing his bidding and was speaking for mm-hmm. him and not just running off on her own and doing anything.
Mm-hmm. One thing that struck me is you guys took off the what political party question are you?
Mm-hmm.
So he and I talked about that. My experience with that is when Bob Smith left Congress the second time
mm-hmm.
and Greg Walden came in, Greg Walden fired all the Democrats in the second congressional district.
Mm-hmm.
And then finding out that Bob Smith, when he went and became speaker, something in the mid-60s, he actually put in a loyalty thing. He would only hire Republicans. And so at some point, I'll be interested to, you know, pick Bob Smith's brain about whatever. But it's just fascinating to look at that. What's the importance of party loyalty as you go through?
So I'm sitting in my office. It's, I don't know, a month, month and a half, 2 months into the administration.
Mm-hmm.
Leo Hagstrom comes in, sits down, and starts talking. And you've seen the layout in that office, but it's basically semi-private.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of open.
Mm-hmm.
Your assistants, your staff, what little I had at that point, are close by. And he goes, so Denny, I need to run something by you. So, okay, what is it, Leo? He says, well, I got a guy I want to hire as the top PR person for the Department of Human Resources. And I said, okay. And I said, but why are you running it by me? And he said, well, that's the way it works. You know, we don't hire in state government a top PR person, maybe even a second or third level PR person, unless the governor's press secretary approves. And I said, well, Leo, there's a new sheriff in town. And, you know, you got hired by the governor, and, you know, I wasn't there when he gave you his marching orders, but I'll guarantee you that they were marching orders that said, within these parameters, this is what I want done, and come back with results, and I'll leave you alone, and do what you want to do, and do what you need to do. And he said, well, yeah. And I said, well, that works in personnel as well. And he said, oh. And I said, look, if I approve who you hire, then I'm responsible for mm-hmm. your PR program.
Mm-hmm.
But you're the one who's responsible for your PR program, and I'm not going to get involved in that, and I'd love to know who it is and all that kind of stuff. And he goes, well, he's working for a Democrat. And we didn't look up party registration, so he didn't even know, and I, mm-hmm. to this day, don't know what his party registration was. And I said, well, who is it? You know, tell me who it is. And now that you know you can hire whoever mm-hmm. you want, tell me. It's Dave Fiskum. Oh, well, I recommended that Dave contact you when I heard the job was open, but he's working for Les Aucoin. I said, I understand that, but he's looking to come back to Oregon, and he is great. I worked with him when he was at Portland State, and I was mm-hmm. at Oregon State, and you know, Hagstrom's face just lightened up. He said, boy, it is a new sheriff in town. I really do get to do what I want to do and don't have to run everything by the corner office. Well, that all got reversed in later administrations.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't get a job in state government unless you were approved by the corner office, which is just short-sighted, if not stupid.
Yeah.
And we didn't care. When we hired people, the best speechwriter I had in the entire time I was there, two of the best I had, I think, are long-time, lifelong Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
But they were people who had a record of being loyal to who they were working for, and they were great and talented people, and who cares what party you were registered in? It's not, mm-hmm. as a speechwriter, you're not writing for yourself. You're writing for this guy.
Yeah, exactly. Let's switch gears a bit.
Sure.
And let's go to some of the fun things. Let's do the Russian issues.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to the governor about the Russian issues, and it ended up being like about 15 minutes of stuff. But so it's clearly a big PR issue. It's clearly a big state governance issue. And he, you know, takes the stance of, I'm not going to talk to him. He's stepped at least one or two steps back.
Mm-hmm.
So Norma Paulus is the one that people see out in front. To a certain extent, Vern Duncan is there as they talk about school stuff. But,
Norma was there really just for the election aspect.
Yeah, just
and
for the
Vern,
election.
Same thing in terms of the school.
Yeah, with their elected.
But Jerry was really the primary contact.
Uh huh. So run me through the Rajneeshis in that time.
Well, it was difficult because the policy in the office, and you really need to talk to Jerry more about this than anything else, but the policy in the office was, you know, we do not get, we don't recognize them in effect.
Right.
And because what they wanted was they wanted, you know, from the federal government, they wanted immigration forgiveness, if you will, with, you know, some sort of religious exemption or something like that. And from the state government, they wanted land use forgiveness. And very quickly, we found out and had intelligence resources that I don't, to this day, know if I'm able to talk right. about them. I don't mean to over-dramatize it, but,
right.
You know, we had intelligence, and we knew that there were a whole lot of very innocent sannyasins, and that there was a core element that were basically criminals. Now, if we'd had proof at that point, you know, Turner would have had them in federal prison someplace earlier than some of them were.
Right.
So, and then they had such a close society that it was hard to get that kind of smoking gun kind of proof. But yeah, they were, you know, this fun-loving, wonderful group of people in purple that the media just loved to cover because they were great, you know, television. You know, automatic weapons and Rolls Royces and flowing robes and free sex and all that kind of stuff. And we pretty much, you will not find, except in a news conference environment, the governor really addressing, except for just the issues of land use planning and antelope and, you know, well, that's an election and that's the way the system works and so on. Underlying all of this is a very, very strong feeling on his part that, as far as these people were concerned, this is religion. And there is you can have the strangest religion in the world, but by golly, you've got the freedom to do it. Now, we knew that there was a lot more going on than just religion, but as far as the innocents were concerned, it was a religion for them. And so we wanted to protect them. We also wanted to protect them from the criminal element that was at the Big Muddy and in downtown Portland and in Antelope. And so you got a really fine balance there between the freedom of religion and protecting Oregonians, whether they're wearing purple or not, and enforcing the law when, in fact, it comes time to do that. The governor was involved in a lot of respects because he had resources. He had the state police. He had the military department. He had the kinds of people who could actually do things. You know, Charles Turner was involved because he had the federal aspect of it, and they had some intelligence things going on as well that were rather amazing. There was a point toward the when it began to mature, and I use that term not as in became more easy to deal with, but as the issues began to come together and it was very clear that they had stashes of weapons and that all this kind of stuff, where I mean where we were, you know, training the National Guard in Clarnell. Because they had armored personnel carriers and lots of people with guns, and they were all of a sudden they had live ammo because they were in Clarnell, and that isn't very far from Antelope and Chanticleer and the Big Muddy, and we knew that they were getting ready to leave. He was getting ready to run off the country, and all this kind of stuff was happening. And a reporter came into me and said, "Denny, you don't understand. This is serious. The reporters know more about this than you guys do." Well, because we were keeping quiet about it. We weren't saying anything. First of all, we didn't want to show our hand. And he said, you know, he just started really saying, "This is not, I'm not speaking as a reporter now. I'm just speaking as an Oregonian. And you guys are just sound asleep on this one. You just really, you can't believe the stuff that we're hearing from good sources and so on." Of course, we knew all that stuff. And we're dealing with it. And we're ready for anything they could do. That was the governor's, I bet he said it during his interview with you. We knew we were ready for anything they could do, quote unquote. And so I said, "Okay, just a minute." I said, "Can I go on absolute deep background with you?" And that, and to me, and I always try to define it for reporters because everybody has a different definition. Not only can you not use this, but you can't even use it to find out about it from somebody else. You know, I'm just trusting you on this because this person was, you know, credible, and I knew this person, and so on and so forth. And I said, "Come with me," after he agreed to that. And we opened up the border control room. And here's a state police officer sitting at a radio in the border control room, antenna wire running out up to the top of the Capitol building. And I forget what the code was, but, you know, "Can you tell me what, you know, Peachtree is what's happening right now?" And so, you know, 99, 95, 96, Peachtree, 95, 96 status. Everything's quiet. 10-4. And the reporter's like, and I said, "Peachtree's on a bluff overlooking the ranch right now." okay, I won't ask any more questions. Thank you. And that was really one of the more obvious ones. I mean, sure, yeah. They knew he was there, but he was on public property or he was on somebody mm-hmm. else's private property. And, mm-hmm. and you know, the governor's executive orders that he luckily didn't have to sign that are sitting down yeah. the hall here, you know, we had planned out just about every possible thing. I mean, it was like when we used to do Trojan drills, you know, right. for the nuclear power plant. This was a nuclear power plant that could overheat, as far as we were concerned. Mm-hmm. And I was with the governor in Taiwan, in a Taiwan hotel, when the guru was getting ready to flee the country. Mm-hmm. And we were talking in code because we were worried they'd tapped our phones. Mm-hmm. But Jerry and the governor had worked out codes, and we knew, of course, the federal government knew exactly where he was at every minute, knew how much petrol he had in his jet, mm-hmm. and how far he could go, and where the last airport was that he would land, and that's where he was arrested.
Yeah.
And so having that kind of involvement, but at the same time, pretty much not putting on, because we really weren't putting on. We just were not responding, and as a result, looked like we were not engaged. Mm-hmm. And most of that occurred, either leading up to or after the re-election campaign. I'd have to get the timeline out. But mm-hmm. so it wasn't really a political matter for us in that sense, but it was just the way he would handle something like that. Just the kind of approach that he would take. Number one, being fair-minded, protecting the innocent, making sure that you knew what was going on, have good people. The state mm-hmm. police were just, they did great work. They just did great work, and the federal government did great work. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to say, you know, that Norma Paulus and Vern Duncan didn't do great work as well. It's just that their scope was rather narrow, whereas the governor's was the whole McGillicuddy.
Well, but their scope was also more on public.
That's true.
I mean, that's the
and they were
thing.
The only time the governor talked about it, we never called any news conferences about it or issued, I don't believe, any press releases on it, mm-hmm. was when he was asked about it in media availabilities.
Yeah.
And his answers were, I'm wondering if those tapes are available. Wouldn't that be nice if those were available down there? If the Legislative Assembly media system had those, that would be something to look into. But what else about Rajneesh or anything else?
Well, one specific Rajneesh thing, because mm-hmm. the governor's not sure if he was poisoned or not.
Right. We're not either.
Okay. Were you there?
Was I at the event? No.
So you just heard the story later.
No, in fact, I'm still trying to... We up to and including the 20th of this month, mm-hmm. regularly covered the governor's health. Mm-hmm. And after he was governor, whenever it affected his schedule, we would put out a release on it.
Right.
And after he was governor, whenever he was admitted to a hospital, we would do something. Those were kind of our guidelines, mm-hmm. rules, whatever. And so I've been trying to correlate what was happening, and I've dealt a little bit with Les Seitz on this, who is probably the most knowledgeable person on this subject on the planet, mm-hmm. More so than most of the Rajneeshis. And we can't correlate that date with anything, what was going on there or something else. My doctor, Bill Drips, was the governor's doctor, mm-hmm. okay, because we both were coming to Salem, and Jerry had a contact, and she was his doctor. He's no longer with us, and years later, before Bill died, mm-hmm. I just said, you know, come on, Bill, time has passed. Mm-hmm. Was there any possibility? And he said, well, doctors don't ever say there's never a possibility, but the fact is we tested for everything, and we don't know why he was sick. And he was, as he says, sicker than he'd ever been before or since.
Yeah.
And, nobody from the sannyasins are going to say anything more about it because they've all done jail time for other poisonings.
Right.
But he certainly had to be a target.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He certainly had to be a target. And we did have the office swept for bugs.
Yeah.
And because we were worried about that, and we would have... We talked about it. We often would talk about it in the Winter Street house rather than in the office, just in case the bugs were missed or mm-hmm. something new had been let. And we don't have any evidence that it ever was bugged, but mm-hmm. they probably would have tried if they could have. Mm-hmm. But the poisoning question to me is an open question, mm-hmm. and I'm not into historical speculation. But A, he was a target. B, right around then he was really, really sick, just before an important event. And C, the doctor who was the attending physician who used to teach classes at the Health Sciences University, along with being my doctor, mm-hmm. flat out said, we don't know. Mm-hmm. Now, He also said, there's a lot of times we don't know.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
You know, they do diagnosis by elimination, or he got well, so why worry about it?
Yeah.
You know, it's not a chronic condition, so why get upset about it?
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's titillating.
Yeah. We don't know precisely also how sophisticated the Rajneeshis were.
Right. There were some that were more sophisticated than others.
Yeah.
And...
So if there was a super bug no one had ever heard of before, the I don't know one suspicion.
Right.
But it's probably just the same thing that they use in other places where it would have shown up.
But by the same token, you know, I'm very hesitant, other than, you know, this happened and this happened and this was going on at the time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which is totally circumstantial.
Yeah.
I'm personally not willing to say I think he was poisoned by the rat. Yeah. I've never said that, in fact. But... the I don't know is a perfect answer to that question.
Absolutely.
There's only the Rather's rule. There's only three answers to any questions from the media. You know, I know I can tell you. I know and I can't tell you. And this is why I can't tell you. And I don't know.
And I don't know.
And I don't know is really hard for politicians.
Yeah.
They don't like to say that.
It's very hard.
Yeah.
It reminds me of my very first graduate student paper. I was doing something on yellow rain. It was early 1980s. So were the Soviets and, you know, poisoning people in... Oh, that was the moment right there.
Yeah, you let there be light.
Poisoning people in Laos and in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And doing all this stuff, doing research on it, I discovered a really interesting thing. Up until 1960, the U.S. State Department travel advisories to Southeast Asia warned against all these diseases, but not bubonic plague.
Hmm.
After 1964, they all warned against bubonic plague.
Hmm.
And one of the rumors that's kind of substantiated, but it's an I don't know question, is the U.S. actually planned to use bubonic plague infected fleas and drop them out of the airplanes.
Hmm.
And so the reason this became an I don't know for me is my dad went to Vietnam in 66,
mm-hmm.
and I vividly remember him being inoculated for bubonic plague because his arm swole up.
Hmm.
It was awful.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went off to war and, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's a total I don't know. So in my paper, it's a long footnote because it can't be in the text because there's nothing there. But, boy, look at all these cool things here.
Yeah, this lines up with this, with this, with this.
Exactly.
This. So it might be, but we don't know.
Mm-hmm. We don't know.
Yeah.
So put it down there. Put it down there. Okay, enough of Rajneeshis.
Mm-hmm.
We've been going for an hour and 40 minutes or so. So let's end up with a kind of a more of a meta Vic.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to him about governing, he really liked governing. I think one of my favorite story so far is him telling his brothers, I'm not coming back to the carpet business. Because
mm-hmm.
it's good to be the governor and not have to deal with co-leaders. He really liked being governor. But in reading the oral history, there's a lot of things that he wasn't able to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me about him as, you know, kind of in my mind, sometimes he's the happy warrior. He just loves this stuff. And sometimes it just rolls off his back. You know, we didn't get that. They're Democrats. You know, I'm a Republican. But there are a lot of things that he proposed, some small, some bigger, that just didn't fly.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me about him, and from your point of view, how big a deal was that to him? You know, he's got the context of the recession going on for most of his time in mm-hmm. office. That's really kind of dictating lots of things.
Except for the first year.
Yeah, except for the first year. But there's lots of ideas that he has that just... You know, some of them make it up so they're almost legislation and then they fail on the floor. Some of them die in committee. But it's just a lot of ideas that just don't quite go. And so, you know, if you were to line up all of his, what he wanted to accomplish as governor as time went on, I have a feeling you'd have successes over here, but you'd have a lot of failures over here.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that like? I mean, in your point of view, is that kind of normal for a governor? Was it because of the bipartisan control issue?
Well, I've only worked and for a very brief period of time after 87 mm-hmm. for Governor Orr of Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And then I helped a senator that she appointed to office due to a death in office just set up his office mm-hmm. and decided he didn't want to ever work in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that there's a way to compare
mm-hmm.
with other governors. But from reading a lot about, let's take Floyd McKay's Sprague
mm-hmm.
thing, and you've read them all, and,
mm-hmm.
and to me, a governor especially who's working with the other party in a time of crisis, you run a lot of things up the flagpole, and you don't necessarily have an expectation that you're going to get them all.
Mm-hmm.
You have a hope that the legislature is going to change, although my recollection is the numbers were spread far enough that that wasn't going to happen.
Right.
So you pretty much have to deal with the reality of it. He would never show that frustration publicly.
Mm-hmm.
He would get frustrated a little bit on things, on executive appointments and the Energy Facility Siting Council and
mm-hmm.
and some things like that.
A lot of frustration over the budget for his office.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and let me finish that thought and then come back to that mm-hmm. because but inside, the door closes and
mm-hmm.
and there's some stomping and there's some flapping of the hand on the desk and you know that he is very unhappy and
mm-hmm.
Why did this person do that and mm-hmm. I thought they were on board and this kind of stuff because he came out of a legislative environment where Ted Halleck was a good friend.
Yeah.
And he got things done in 77 because he worked well with Jason Bowe, who was more conservative than his caucus by a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so the two of them together got things done and such. So he came out of an environment, I like the word comity, because he thought that's the way it ought to work. Well, mm-hmm. if you look, hindsight, through the lens of history, as you guys like to say, that was kind of where things were starting to change.
Yeah.
The post-Watergate, not so much the media, although they were changing as well, but all of the redistricting and stuff that was going on that ended up with, maybe four or five competitive Senate districts and 10 competitive
yeah.
House districts now.
If we're lucky.
If you're lucky, yeah, exactly, depending upon how they recruit and everything else. And so people were much more ideological, and that's also when, Walter Huss and Bill Sizemore, all these kinds of things started to be happening at that point, and doctrinaire sort of decisions, not I'm doing this because it's good for Oregon, which is the way he was brought mm-hmm. up. So it was more of a philosophical shock
mm-hmm.
to him. I guess I would say it's analogous to Governor Kitzhaber wearing jeans to a joint session.
Yeah,
that just was beyond the pale as far as he was concerned.
Yeah.
Or as he says, the person who followed me in office basically being a rapist.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that just would distress him greatly, and it was an indication of how he would approach something as a policy matter in the legislature as well. So it really was a change around him,
mm-hmm.
A Copernicum moment, if you will.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, instead of everybody thinking that everything rotated around the Earth, everything rotated around something else, and the Earth was... And so the legislature changed the way it did things.
Yeah.
I like to say that you could really depend on legislators to do the right thing for Oregon, and there are some right now with great respect for people who are willing to run for office that they're so doctrinaire that they would want to do it based on the doctrine, not necessarily what's going to be good for the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
And I would chastise them for that.
Yeah.
I've chastised, I'm going to an event at Peter Courtney's house on Monday, I think, that is a fundraiser for Democrats, and I'm going to it because Senator Courtney, great respect for the governor, and he wants me to make a pitch for the archives here so that these people
mm-hmm.
will deliver some stuff
mm-hmm.
and to tell them when the thing is going to be. And Peter was on the phone with me within 12 hours of the governor's death,
mm-hmm.
saying, whatever you need, whatever you want, you just mm-hmm. you just holler, you call Debbie, she'll take it, that kind of thing. Well, he's from the old school.
Yeah.
And, he's still impressed by the fact that when he was a freshman legislator, he got in to meet with the governor on an issue.
Yeah.
And that's old school as well. And is there anybody who's been in the legislature longer than him now? I don't think so. So there's a classic, anchor point here of what it used to be and what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Oregon actually was slower than some other states and certainly slower than Congress to get into that kind of position.
Yeah. So it took until really the 94 election is really what swung it.
So, yeah, he would be very frustrated with that and very unhappy with that and disappointed in that. But it was lucky for him. It was better, at least back then, than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I can't even, you know, ferret out one issue over another on something like that. You remember that he met weekly with the leadership. And those were substantive meetings. I was not in them 99.9% of the time, but they were substantive meetings, and that's where things were worked out, because in the Oregon legislature, the leadership has pretty much the throttle on everything, and they can decide whether something lives or dies, and that's where the negotiations really occurred. And so there were a lot of things that you use the word failure. I would say things that didn't fly, but
that's fair. It just struck me. Especially talking about his second, the first term, the recession comes in, but it's a lot of kind of catching up, it seems, just in the way he remembers it.
Mm-hmm.
Second term, hey, you know, they elected me because they trusted me over Ted for ideas to keep guiding us out of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there's an uptick and we're going to go recruiting, there's an uptick and all that kind of stuff. So there's the second term seems to be much more of Vicatia's term.
Yeah, that's certainly when he did most of the trade missions and it's a second term for an Oregon governor until recently is the one where you don't feel any even subtle subconscious pressure on you. But I think that those are just part of the game and part of the understanding. I'll even go so far, Jim, as to say that I think it probably hurt him more when his successor publicly and with alacrity announced that he was going to dismantle everything that Vicatia had done. Because everything he has done is bad just by definition, because he's the one who took the lead on it. Now, he didn't successfully dismantle everything.
No.
But his statement about, you know, we're going to get rid of the dry rot in state government... just cruel kinds of things. He was talking about people, and okay, fine, you can get your people in, and that's good too.
Right.
But as it turns out, he's a moral degenerate. So, you know, what good does it do that you bring in all these people?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, party loyalty comes back in. And so that bothered him probably more than when you were in the game and you had the veto pen and you had agency heads implementing things. I mean, I presume it might be a little scary to say this, analogous to our current president. You have some authority you can just get done. You know, the power to initiate as an executive is fairly strong. I think you would probably have the chart on this, but I think Oregon's kind of in the middle in states where the extremely powerful governors and the extremely weak governors in what you can just get done through appointment process and stuff.
Right.
And so you there's some things you can just do without the legislature, but you still have to have the budget.
Yeah.
Governor's office budget. You want to talk about that?
We
let that go by.
Well, just a quick aside.
Yeah.
The two weakest governors in the entire country, Arkansas and Texas.
Is that right?
Yes. Clinton and Bush. Just saying.
The first time I met Bill Clinton, it was in Taiwan, but it might have been Japan or one of those places. Anyway, Arkansas had a trade mission going the same time we had a trade mission going, and he jumped on the bus and he says, "Nick, you got all the business already. I'm arriving late. No, I'm going to no kind of." He was just a bumpkin, you know.
That's great.
He was just a bumpkin.
Uh-huh. Governor's office budget.
Yeah. well, when we came into office. We sent Lee in, basically, to go to the Ways and Means Committee and the leadership and said, you know, there's a phantom governor's budget.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've got this little narrow thing you call the governor's budget, and then there is this circle out here in the agencies where people who are working for you but are on agency budgets.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're appointed by you, they report to you, and all that kind of stuff, and we think that that is, you know, just... not immoral, but it's, you know, it's wrong.
Yeah.
Let's be honest about it. Let's have a fair budget. So I think our budget actually inched up just a bit, but the number of people we had and the salaries we had were, way lower than what Straub ended up with. I keep the name of his press secretary. Just keeps flashing in my mind. Anyway, they compared his salary with my salary, and it was like 30, 40% above what I was making. So we wanted a kind of a truth in budgeting approach to the governor's office budget. But the legislature saw fit then to just say, okay, I mean, they crossed the boundary of the legislative versus the executive to try and throttle us by reducing the amount of resources that we had. And after we had said, we're going to come clean with our budget, we're going to be honest about our budget, and we're not going to station people everywhere, then they did that to us. Well, I'm sorry, that really irritated the guy.
Right.
And he was paying rent on the Winter Street house.
And they raised his rent.
And they raised the rent. And that irritated the guy. So,
yes.
You know, every time we took, and of course, to this day, the governor has to pay rent on their on his office. Mm-hmm. And so it's the kind of thing that, you know, you really wonder where the executive branch and the legislative branch, you know, interact on that. We saw it as kind of punitive, really. I mean, we saw it as much more them attempting to reduce our authority and our ability. But we had plenty of people. We got things done. And we had agency heads who were, you didn't need to have governor staff. You didn't have to have them by the throat and have them working for you. And we certainly did not have a patronage system involved. And patronage just doesn't work. I'm sorry. It is backwards. Yeah, you achieve a certain amount of loyalty, but you have a certain amount of loyalty from people who are incompetent. And what good is that?
Yeah.
You don't get things done with that. You end up with more problems than you can shake a stick at.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. When you were talking about Goldschmidt coming in and saying we're going to get rid of all the dry rot, it's fascinating. He did that in 87. And then 7 years later, 94, that's Republican talk. That's total revolutionary Republican talk. And it's not on the Democratic side anymore.
Right.
It's just fascinating how that switched so quickly.
Yeah.
Because it's very successful, and voters connect with it.
Right.
They really connect with it.
Yeah. Well, and again, you get this whole thing is what's negative and what's just, you know,
exactly.
What's rhetoric and what's real, and you can go round and round and round on something like that.
Yeah. So. Good.
So what's your plan for this kind of interview discussion, and especially as in terms of me allocating time and your time frames and things like that? We're going to talk again, I guess.
We're going to talk again.
Okay.
There's still other stuff that I want to get your take on. But basically, I'm hoping to be doing stuff like this until school starts. But school starts only in 3 weeks.
Yikes.
So, you know, That's just
how come it's hard to find a parking spot out here on the street?
There's something, it says event parking.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know what the event is.
Okay.
But I think event.
Yeah.
and so, but because I've now, you know, the governor has passed, I'm now 80% through all of those oral history things. Boy, there's a lot of words in there. So I'm that's helping me to focus. You know, I go down and say, oh, there was a letter from the Reagan administration on deficit spending, you know, that he sent and sent back, so I need to mark that down. There's, you know, all these kinds of things. So I'm basically putting together kind of a list of here's the archival stuff that I know I need to do, as well as general archival stuff. And also giving me more specifics to come to people like you. So in the fall, when classes are going, this slows way, way, way down. But I'm hoping to do at least probably 5 or 6 interviews, not with you, all of them.
No,
but 5 or 6 interviews with people, hither, thither, and yon. And quite frankly, my priority sheet is I'd love to pick your brain on it. But I have the governors from Margie's list. She had who she'd interviewed, and he went through and marked who's dead, who's less healthy, etc. So I need to hit that. That's my priority list.
So, if we're talking just strategy for your project, let's turn that off and
sure.
We're not talking on the record then,
sure.
And we can
2 hours, 2 minutes, and 49 seconds.
Wow.